Yeah, the question is whether there's, I'll get repeated in my transparencies, but there's so few of them that I can waste some time. You've got the supernova surface here, and you've got junk coming out, and several kinds of neutrinos, but you have electron neutrinos with a momentum like that, and you have mu and tau neutrinos with a greater momentum. And it would be remarkably interesting if there were some mechanism that mixes those guys rapidly, so that the effective spectrum of electron neutrinos was more energetic farther up on above when it gets to do what it does. That's the first thing I have to say. I'm going to rub that out immediately. At the talk I gave at the conference, I fulminated against people who went to the bottom line without having the physics right beforehand, and so I will retract anything I said about supernova here for a brief time. And now I'll say something else I'll have to retract, probably. Forward, things scattering forward are different from other things. Well, I mean, you know that, but the supposition of some of what I'm going to say is that maybe there's something special about a one kind of neutrino, a new E that comes in like that, and then goes out like this with exactly the same momentum as a new tau that came in like this. And went out like this. In short, these things didn't change their momenta, but they exchanged a property. Now, I was looking over the audience just, you know, while I was dithering there to begin with, and I was saying, if there's somebody in here who does not obviously know what I mean when I say the neutral current interaction, I was going to write the Hamiltonian on the board. Doug Scalapina walked in, and he has no reason he should know what the neutral current interaction is. So I'll just say, hey, Doug, it's something that it'll do this. Well, okay, but it's forward and it's not forward. You exchange some quality, then you don't interfere with the initial wave, do you? So, but rather than get involved with words over that, I'm gonna rub that out too. But keep it in mind. I mean, there is something rather special about forward scattering, isn't there? In fact, if you do a very unwise thing, there's a medium, you know, things sort of randomly distributed scatterers say, and you decide to put a wave packet, which is very much like a plane wave here moving in this direction, and then so virtually all the momentum is in this direction, and then you look and you ask what's the angular distribution as a function of time that you would find for that entire assemblage of particles. Then, as time goes on, a very short time, it's just each particle is scattered off a near thing, and it's all sort of isotropic, if the scattering is isotropic. But as time goes on, this thing develops the angular distribution, say, and measuring from here, this is the amplitude as a squared amplitude as a function of angle. And so as a function of time, this guy would develop a longer and longer a nose that's growing, you know, like mine will as I tell you more lies, as it evolves forward in time. There's something very special about forward. Now, earlier on in the workshop, and gee, I think only Gary was here maybe, Alex Friedland gave a talk. And it seemed to be, well, I was sitting here, I didn't exactly, my entire thought during the talk was, why is he doing that, you know? why is he doing this? Instead of looking at what are supposed to be the equations for the density matrices for neutrinos doing this and that, he was drawing these pictures, much like the one I just drew, in which nu twos and nu e's and nu taus collided. Work with Cecilia Lunardini, and I didn't want to get too much into some of the complexities of it, but the bottom line was that if you have a beam of nu taus and you have a nu e coming in and colliding with them, then he just looked perturbatively to ask himself whether there were some collective effects over this thing doing this thing with one, the other, and the other. And he concluded that in the correct limit, the limit of constant density and large volume, there was no action, which is, I believe, a correct conclusion. And then the second thing that they did was sort of confirm that if you do the same thing and you come in here with a mixture, I'm sorry, it doesn't say on that transparency what nu x is. It's some linear combination of your nu e and nu tau, okay? So think of it as 50-50 for... Then, of course, you've got things here that are not orthogonal combinations, and you're two in your two beams, and that is to say, in the flavor space. Then you get a result that's in accord with the Raffelt-Siegel equations, which I'll come to much, much later as an afterthought, which are supposed to describe the evolution of these neutrinos in terms of single particle density matrices. So they concluded, well, we had to look at this, but it didn't get us anything out of the ordinary. And I want to forget all that for a moment, too. Now, again, just for context, the top is what I said about supernova over here. You've got two different neutrinos with different energy spectra. Above the neutrino sphere, you wonder what they can do. But let me come back just to the list of how neutrinos are affected by an environment. Is there a pointer here someplace? How many times have I heard that question asked, and there it was, and... Yeah, sure. Of course. Well, that's in four distinct ways. Actually, they're fairly distinct. Okay, scattering. Scattering cross-section is like GF squared omega squared, and that defines a rate, or I wrote an inverse time, proportional to the density times the cross-section density of scatterers, whatever they are. That matters below the neutrino sphere, but if you come out above, of course, that's the definition of the neutrino sphere. Stuff doesn't scatter very much. It's going to scatter enough way up there in order to maybe heat the upper atmosphere of this thing and drive away heat the material enough to drive it away and make a supernova or not make a supernova. It's not that we don't care about the scattering up there, but on the average, a neutrino will not get scattered above the neutrino sphere. So for a moment, we put that aside. We're looking for bigger fish. Now, there's also, in all neutrino oscillation in media analyses, it's really important to know the energy difference between one flavor and another, and that's proportional to just GF times the number density of electrons, the electron scattering off the electron being the thing that normally makes a different energy difference between these species, and an inverse time, that is to say, what's usually just a phase factor, oscillating phase factor, which is of order GF rather than GF squared. Now, in the region we're considering, this is a much, much shorter time than this. Well, GF is real small. And although I present this as an energy difference, there will be people who will say it's due to forward scattering, right? Forward scattering always just measures the energy of interaction with the medium anyway. So we're keeping our eye on this one, but for completeness, let me move down. There's another kind of scattering actually that matters. It's totally neglected in the literature and in the applications people are doing, I believe. It's just scattering of order GF squared, but instead of being from the single particles in some thermal ensemble, if you have big macroscopic electron density variations, then you can get real big cross sections from very nearly forward scattering. And of course, that wouldn't matter for just momentum transport or something like that. The scattering angle is infinitesimal, but it does matter for flavor physics. And you could just as well have asked me to talk about that, but I won't. Wonderful. Finally, neutrino-neutrino interactions. That's what I had on that slide. And I'm repeating what I said before. If we take initial distributions that are flavor diagonal, there seem to be no effects from the standard density matrix equation. So with all that lore under our belts, I'm going to start over again and write down a Hamiltonian where I still don't have the factors right. That should be a 1 over square root of 2, I think, but let it pass. Well, it depends on what F is. The A's work on electron neutrinos. The B's work on what I'm trying to consistently call the tau neutrinos, the other kind of neutrino here. These are the terms in which the two flavors exchange their momenta. You may, if you went back to the Hamiltonian in coordinate space, you would then maybe say, well, look here, you've not put in the term with AP adjoint, AP, BQ adjoint, BQ, summation, P naught equal to Q, or P equal to Q, all short circuits, some niceties here. But the answer to that is that this is just a number operator for the number of electron neutrinos, and this is a number operator for the number of tau neutrinos. And so as long as I don't get into any state that has a linear combination with where those numbers are different, I'm okay. Of course, in that state that I had written down over here with or on my transparency with some new x's, some linear combinations coming in, then the number operator for this guy would be different in different, the state would be a superposition of different numbers, and I wouldn't be able to throw this away. For the examples I'm going to work out, though, I don't want it, because it would just be a phase factor on the evolution equation. And since I'm going to get in very quickly to numerical work that exhausts all the capacity on my my Dell desktop computer in there, I don't want to put in any unnecessary terms in the interaction matrix, and I don't want to have any unnecessary oscillations that make it harder for the computer to reach a conclusion. So this is okay for the states that I'll pick below. I'm going to take, well, I need to explain this on the transparencies. I'm going to take n of one kind and n of another kind. I'm going to take them for conceptual simplicity. I'm going to take my first n here all in one region of some phase space, and the second n all in the other in another region of phase space. So it's sort of an extreme limit of in which these things don't overlap at all. But and so I can imagine starting with a vector which is, if one is an electron neutrino and minus one is a tau neutrino, then for these states, as we read down, here would be an initial state. Electrons up here, taus down here. And all my interaction does is permute these ones and minus ones here. It changes the flavors, okay? and that's what I show down here. Here's any old vector with equal numbers of ones and minus ones. And you see this particular part of H, one term in H, will exchange this guy in here. So the complete H does an exchange on every possible pair there. Now, how many basis states are there in this system? Well, it's quite a few. I mean, if we have an infinite number of particles, it's pretty large. It's 2n factorial over n factorial squared. 2 to the 2nth. Divided by square root of 2 pi n, using Stirling's formula. So it's a bunch of states. Is there any point in writing stuff like this down? Remember, in my Hamiltonian, I had some coefficients, different strengths for different transitions. In the so-called real model, you'd want to have that in there because guys going at different angles actually have a different matrix element. There's a 1 minus cosine theta. So you want to have a distribution of strengths there in the original Hamiltonian. But let me for a moment assume it's all ones and zeros. Actually, it doesn't make any difference to the gross properties of the system. For a while, I was worried that some huge symmetric group consideration would make the cases different, but it doesn't. I have this Hamiltonian. It exchanges pairs. I can write down an H next to an H and start with a basis state and just say, you know, I sit there and say it goes here this many, it can go this many places, it can go this many places. I can see how to get that basis state back to itself just by sitting there at the desk. Any one of them, the diagonal matrix element of that completely symmetric Hamiltonian squared in the basis has this n squared factor here. And that's the key to what's going to happen. So if we take the square, we can take the... Well, the trace is zero. It's all off diagonal, right? It's... I'm going to learn something about the eigenvalue spectrum. That's all. No physics anymore.
Greg, I may have missed it, but what is the physics that you're interested in?
Oh, I'm interested in, there are two cases in which it's thought that neutrino-neutrino scattering of massive neutrinos makes a difference at the moment.
What's the difference in what?
In the physical results. Now, in the supernova, if the spectra come out, get drastically changed, so the electron neutrinos have more energy, then they can heat that stuff out there much more efficiently, right? Although you lose maybe on the nucleosynthesis part, but the autopresis part, but let it pass. Then there's the other problem in the very early universe that you know something about and Yvonne knows something about, but I know precious little about, but that is another case where neutrino-neutrino interactions en masse may make a difference. I can't think of any other case where the flavor physics matters. Eventually in accretion disks, but let it pass. So my trace of H squared is the sum of the squares of the eigenvalues. And this is an average mean root of an eigenvalue. And you see the replacing N over V by density, which I'm calling rho, although eventually I'll call the density matrix for a single particle rho as well, so be a little careful. But this is the density of neutrinos, Fermi constant. Now, if the average energy is like this, and then you start out with a state, and it mixes into a whole lot of different states with different energies of this order, then the mixing time will be the inverse of this average energy. We cannot conclude yet that that actually happens, but that's the direction we're going. Or to say it more formally, you advance your state in time, taking the ground state that I already put up there, and we can calculate, say, the persistence of the one in the first state. Probability that that your first electron neutrino has not become a tau. And that's the number I want to know. And so if I arrange my huge set of states such as the first NS over two of them, NS being that abominably large number, are the 50% of the states that have basis states that have one here, then I have to take this sum. So let me turn my optimistic prediction around there and say, what would you have to do to avoid getting this kind of mixing? Well, one way would be if you took all that strength that I had in the absolute, in the sum of the squares of the eigenvalues, and you put it into one state, which then would overlap by 1 over the square root of n with each one of these guys, and so you'd get a little bit of the system, which would go like crazy, but it wouldn't matter in the large volume limit. Yes?
Charge exchange reaction, if you do it in the center of mass, it's just backwards scattered. You've got new E coming in and goes out, and the momentum goes out looking like a new tau. And so is there anything, and so is what you're saying is there may be something special about backwards scattering that's not shared with all angles?
Well, I'm going to call it forward scattering with exchange of equality, so it's a matter of terminology. And you have to let me come back to the end to say what forward has to do with this. That is, you could say, you have to let me come back to that at the end so that we don't get into an interminable discussion. But if you say it's backward scattering, then somebody else will say, what's so special about 180 degrees? What about 97 degrees? And I will come back and say something that's different. I don't intend that, I don't believe I have perfect control over this, which is why I'm going to all right, we need to verify the spectrum doesn't consist of a few states with eigenvalues much, much, much bigger and majority with eigenvalues less, so that we get nothing in the limit of volume goes to infinity rather than something. Volume goes to infinity Kant's density. Well, actually, in this completely symmetric problem where we set all these weights equal to 1, there are analytic formulas which I still can't derive. And I hate not being able to derive stuff that I use, but I've been able to check them, so I guess I'm happy with that part. And for in a minute, I'll show you a picture of the large for equal N1 and N2. I'm sorry, this was over elaborate. I've got N1 equal N2 in the example that I'm taking. In a moment, I'll plot an eigenvalue density plot using these guys. But also, we've done numerical work up to the last point where we can stand it, 2n equals 14, for the case where we use distributed strengths. And you'll see the strengths here are distributed between 0.5 and unity. So we've got a scatter of strengths. And here is a plot with it's a constant number of It's the eigenvalue spectrum, okay? What more can I say? It's scaled to be from 0 to unity. Each given distance here contains the same number of eigenvalues. Huge degeneracies in the completely symmetric case. The degeneracies are absolutely lifted by that F function that I put in. So you see, the importance of this curve is to see how well we're doing already for a small number of particles. The only trouble is that my number of particles isn't that small. It's 2n that's 14. I have n of each, and it's 2n that's 12. I don't have 28 particles. But I didn't bring the pen to correct that with.
What's a negative energy? Negative with respect to what?
The zero. I only care about the differences. Tom, I only care about the differences, and the trace of H is zero. The integral of that function there is zero. Yeah. For the n equals 14 case, it involves constructing a matrix with which is 3,424 by 3,424, something like 12 million matrix elements. So to do numerical work, you have to start out with some set of basis states. This is for 8 particles here. There are only 70. It's for 14 particles at the 3,400. And yeah, see, I mean, did you ever want to know what those are? Well, there they are. And with my distributed strength, here's a little corner of the 70 by 70 matrix. You see, it isn't that sparse. I mean, it looks sparse here, but if you keep on running this direction out to 70, the numbers will appear. You see, they're not between, these numbers are not between one half and unity, as I promised. In this problem, as you increase n, you have to decrease the coupling constant because there's a 1 over v here, and you want to keep n over v constant. So the coupling is scaled down at each n in order to make the physics, we hope, the same. The picture I showed of the eigenvalue distribution tends to say the physics is the same. Now let's look at the time development. It's the persistence of that first state as I defined it before. Now this I can't do. We can't do analytically. I mean, maybe somebody can. For the case of a completely symmetric matrix, I was half expecting Tony to speak up and say, oh, that's trivial, this matrix with all these ones and totally invariant under the symmetric group of n things and pretty sparse. But we don't know how to do that, so here we've looked at just the first state up here, that is the first position, the first momentum, if you will, in our momentum picture, and asked how long does that take to turn into the admix a fair amount of nu tau to the original nu e that was sitting there. P is the persistence. 0.5 is where you're going to end in the end. I mean, oscillating around 0.5. The units of time are, I mean, the square root of 2 keeps appearing and disappearing, but it's the inverse of the number density times the Fermi constant, directly in that picture. And you see, as we go from 6 to 8 to 10 to 12 to 14, it does look like we're approaching some limit, some universal curve. There wasn't all that much difference between the time you got to the second maximum or even the first minimum as we went from 12 to 14. One of my concerns in this, though, and this is something you ought to be able to, somebody ought to be able to prove, is that I want to go to infinity. I think it's rather interesting to speed up where you have, over what you might have expected, where you have only 14 things. But for neutrinos, you do want to go to infinity. And possibly, for all I know, there could be some 1 over logarithmic behavior that said that, okay, the thing just slowly, as you increase in the thing, does the same thing, but more slowly and more slowly and more slowly, so that once you got up to n equals 10 million, it wouldn't turn over until here, and then it would be useless. So that's one reason for caution. There's a bit of mathematics there that amateurs like our group, and typically I've forgotten to tell you what I should have said right at the very beginning, and that is that once I got into describing this work, it's all with Nicole Bell and Andy Rawlinson. And mostly by email at that. So I'm cautiously optimistic about this, but there's another way to try to finesse this problem, and that is to start with the distribution of eigenvalues, and then you ask yourself, could there really be eigenstates so carefully arranged that that for every guy in the list, each guy that you're going to talk about, that guy only talks to a few eigenvalues a few eigenstates, mainly talks to a few eigenstates within a small energy band. And many times I thought I had the answer in that form. But that may turn out not to be the critical issue here after all. So I'll move to some other ones. Oh, so what I'm saying is, tentative conclusion, yes, there is a fast, from the particle physicist's point of view, unexpectedly fast change in this average quantity, which would mean that you might get this mixing over right outside the supernova in a centimeter instead of 25 kilometers. Yeah.
By neutrino scattering, forward scattering.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, people are putting neutrino forward scattering from the point of view of the Rafelt and Siegel equations, which I'm just coming to. And I'll say only a little bit about that. With our initial condition, their equations would give null for this effect.
Null meaning no mixing.
No mixing. They would get mixing only if you have some non-orthogonal flavor mixtures in my one and my two state here. And I was going to give the briefest explanation of how that comes about, because I think what I'm saying here is better than anybody looking at their paper, but that's, you know, just vanity. I've restored the Hamiltonian that does the job here, only this time I've put in the PPQQ term, because we're doing analytic stuff and because we will want to consider systems which are not in an eigenstate of the summation AP of the number of electron neutrinos or the number of tau neutrinos by themselves. And it's very sloppy. I may have a sign or an I and undoubtedly a two wrong here. But you see, the point is you define operators here, like density operators for the three directions of flavor space. And you then you define a sum, an integral, sort of a charge that corresponds to this charge density in k-space. And then you just perform commutators. You look at the equations of motion for these guys, and it's simple. The commutators of these guys come out in terms of the guys themselves and the components of Q. These are operator equations, right? I haven't made any reference to the state that you're evolving from. We actually are looking for this guy in the Heisenberg picture. Sort of a trivial remark, but I needed Doug to tell me this the other day. Remember that, Doug? You've already forgotten. Yeah. And of course, these commutators are true for the Heisenberg operators as well. They're just commutators. Or I'll rewrite this as the density operator commuting with H, just this part of the H, the part that did my action, and this other stuff is the vector product of the density on a mode times the sum over modes. So you see, to get interaction out of this, you have to have a system which has a different flavor composition in one part of the spectrum than the other. Otherwise, it would be dead zero. Now, if the system is described by one particle density matrices, now, is the system described by one particle density matrices? Yeah, if in this operator product here, we can replace the right-hand side by expectation values of the same things, because then we write equations for rho dots, but Q is just dependent on rho, so it's a nonlinear, it's a differential integral equation, if you like, because Q is the sum over all modes K. If you could do that, then you would get an equation where here's the term I'm talking about here. It's a vector product. But at some point, I wanted to put in the full-fledged transport equation that you might want to consider in problems like this. It's got, well, this is the neutrino oscillation term. It's a cumbersome notation, but that's the way it works if you want to do the vector representation for the density matrices. And this osc here, that's just the ordinary neutrino oscillation matrix in the flavor representation. And this term down here is the scattering term that you may or may not need. And to which inadequate attention has been paid, probably both in the certainly in the supernova application and probably in the early universe application. I don't know. What do you think, Yvonne? Is the scattering going to matter there? Early universe neutrino evolution. Well, for completeness, I guess I shouldn't wander into what lambda is or where it comes from, but this is the name of the right-hand side here is it's an equation in Lindblad form, and for the case that I worry about the most, lambda would be a matrix which picked out the electrons and was Hermitian adjoint, and gamma would be something that had to do with the average GF times squared times the average. Density fluctuation. In the medium. Somebody should get on the case of that, actually, because the simulators have produced this very, very mixed up, ugly flow of turbulent stuff, which must have huge density fluctuations in it. There's a problem that I didn't touch on yet, which was central in Friedland and Leonardini, and that is when you start with one guy up and all the rest down. Right? Our interaction just mixes every pair. The answer is very, very different. In effect, when you plow through that the same way that I did the case where there were N and N, you'll find that, yeah, all the strength in the completely symmetric case, all the strength has gone into one eigenvalue. And nothing happens, and if you do a jumble of coupling constants, it's still enough like this so that there's no action. Here's an example of that. This is the persistence again. The time scale, units are the same, Everything is the same. The time scale is vastly bigger than we had before. And you can see that once we get up to a large number of particles, almost nothing is happening. On our earlier time scale, almost nothing happens except for the smallest number of particles. And so we do confirm Friedman and Leonardini's conclusion for that case. And I'm not sure if we agree with their argument or not. Just one other subject. I put entanglement into the title of this talk, and I probably people that think that that's already some kind of demagoguery, because every many body system is entangled, isn't it? But it's. It's sort of there. You know, on the slide before last, I didn't emphasize enough the following. I can find the damn thing. My one really important point, I forgot to mention it. Oh, well. It was the one where I said if you could replace those that operator product by the expectation of the individual operators, that you would have these guys' equation back and it does nothing. Of course, I strongly implied, well, then in our model, you cannot make that replacement. And it's true. In our model, that's what we showed, that replacement, if you turn the crank on this particular model, all questions of physics aside, then that replacement becomes illegal. On the other hand, if we go back to the Friedman and Leonardini sort of picture and ask, understand we don't mean literally 90 degrees, we just mean some other point of the phase space here. And we take new E's and new X's, and we take this thing to be a simple product state, uncorrelated state of these mixtures and these guys here, then if we take the expectation value of the right-hand side of a typical term of the nonlinear operator evolution equation, then it's true that this thing is given by this thing times this thing. It's because the original state I have here doesn't have the correlations in it that develop over time that made our other thing go. Or to put it another way, so the time derivative at time zero is correctly given by Riffelt and Sigel. Well, for longer times, supposing we have both of these things, it needs another simulation. I only got to 14 because, of course, when I tried 16, my Mathematica on my desktop in here, that's a Dell computer, you know. And I'll tell you something interesting, maybe the most interesting thing you will hear in this talk. When I was ordering that computer, I went over and talked to Glenn Schifferl. And I said, geez, I think I want to get the 2 gigabyte RAM. And he said, well, if you want to do fancy graphics and stuff, you need that, but you don't need that for ordinary physics. And I said, well, I have this Mathematica, and it slows down, you know, sometimes, and because it's putting stuff back and forth on the hard disk. And then it's useless. And he said, but can Mathematica use those resources? And the answer is, it can. This 14 that I was bragging about, the 14 particles, Nicole Bell back at Fermilab, cannot do the calculation on her computer that has 1 gigabyte. You need the 2 gigabytes, and Mathematica can use it. Is that surprising? And it's not a matter of putting stuff in the hard disk. It won't even write the matrix for you. If I go to n equals 16, it's not willing to split a matrix between the RAM and the disk. So entanglement is what we need. I'll also give a short statement of credentials on that. Understand, I'm not talking about physics now. I'm talking about my personal credentials to stand up here and talk about entanglement. Ray Voulkos and Nicole and Yvonne and I, at one time, a couple of years ago, among other things, looked at something which is very much like this. It's a double well, and there are two particles in it. And, they both go back and forth, and flavor is over here, over there. And you let the two part, you start out with them independent, you let them interact, and it's got entanglement. Entanglement develops just because of the interaction. Now, it surprised us in the first 15 minutes, but after that, of course, every system with more than one body gets entangled. And it's a trivial thing with two bodies. Remember that entanglement is always... Well, it's a trivial thing for the case of a pure wave function, which is what I've been talking about over here. If you go and you talk about a density matrix, even for the 2x2 case, oh, you can't imagine the literature. And what we were doing was we were putting in two kinds of noise here. One sideblind noise where it doesn't do stuff to your entangled oscillations. The other was side sensing noise, which does destroy the entanglement. And then we were calculating these, I can't remember the names of the adjectives, but we were calculating the entanglement and formation, which you crib out of papers from the IBM people. And at this point in time, I can't say why we were doing that, but now I know why. It's because I can now claim that I have the credentials to talk about it. You probably argue one way or the other about whether that's the key to whatever I think I'm finding here. But I will say, you remember, you remember Bob and Alice, that he's, there's this qubit and this qubit, and they come and they do stuff and they come out the other side. Well, Bob and Alice are still at it. You can't turn your back on them. But instead of being qubits now, they've got whole labs to themselves. Right? Bob's lab and Alice's lab. And just look at all that entanglement. Well, that's something like we have, I guess, from the latest Physics Today article I haven't read. It may not be entanglement, and it may not survive. I gave you one point I'm unsure about. There may be there may be some other points I'd rather that the other points were raised by you guys than me, though, even though I know what they are. So thanks.